Well, good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We will begin this meeting on Sunday morning with a reading of the Declaration and the announcements. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part inside issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither bylaws, constitution, bylaws, office, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. We meet twice a week, on Sunday mornings and Wednesday evenings. On a Sunday morning such as today, the doors actually open at 10:30, and the meeting begins promptly at 11, from 11 to 12 noon. This month, for the month of November, the Sunday talks fall under the umbrella topic of the synthesis of science and religion. This morning's talk will be on the law of unity, and next Sunday morning's talk will be the law of justice and mercy. On Wednesday evenings, the doors open at 5:15, and for 2 hours until 7:15, there is a public reference library available. We don't check books out, but you're certainly welcome to come in and pursue any course of theosophical study that you're interested in. There's always a student available to help you with any kind of research that you're doing. Also, there's a book table in the foyer with theosophical literature, straight-line theosophical books, pamphlets, and magazines, which are available for sale for study at home. Also, you can go online. Pretty much everything that we have at that table is online for free, and you can speak with the individual at the table for what the website is, etc., etc. The Sunday evening classes, Wednesday evening classes, so 5:15 to 7:15 is the library, and then at 7:30 the class starts on Wednesday evening in the Ocean of Theosophy, by William Q. Judge. We are currently in the chapter on general laws and principles. The United Lodge of Theosophists is entirely sustained by voluntary contributions of time, effort, and money. There's a lot of good folks who put a lot of time into the lodge. Nobody gets paid for anything. So if you choose to make a contribution so that this facility can be around for future generations, just as past generations have made contributions and sacrifices for us, you're certainly welcome to make that contribution, knowing that every penny goes into maintaining the lodge, paying the bills, and it doesn't pay for services from the students. So, of course, all these meetings with the ULT, the United Lodge of Theosophists, are always open and free to the public. There's no obligation imposed or implied on anyone. So, without further ado, we'll begin. The topic for this morning is the unity. The law of unity. Kind of a big topic. But we found that there's this saying that comes to us from Pythagoras. It says, "Man, know thyself, and you will know God and the universe," which is very interesting because the implication right there is that in certain ways we must be identical with God and the universe if we can know God and the universe by learning more about ourselves. And in fact, that's actually what theosophy is all about. The secret doctrine, the subtitle for the secret doctrine is what? Cosmogenesis and anthropogenesis, the universe and man. That's what the secret doctrine is, what it's about. And we are told that if one chooses to make a study of the secret doctrine, that one must make the effort to comprehend, to understand the law of unity of all of life. If you're not doing that, the message is then theosophy's probably not for you. It's a waste of time. So today we're going to take a look at what is this law of unity, because you know, we can say that, you know, a lot of times we say that, you know, behind all of life is one spirit, but where do you see it? You know, how do we know that? It seems like so many disparate things, people, organizations, and personal motives, and where's the unity in all of it? Well, for sure, it's natural for people to see the unity of all in all. And if we have a hard time seeing that unity, then it's probably because we're accepting certain ideas that are false. So before we talk about all of that, let's talk about someone who hasn't even had a chance yet to think about false ideas. How about, think of any 5-year-old child, your grandchild, your niece, your nephew, your own. So this little girl, if you ask this little girl, her name's Stacy. Stacy, what do you think of when I say Mommy and Daddy and Billy and Susie and Johnny? Stacy's going to say, well, that's my family. She's not going to say, that's the 5 people I live with. She's not going to say it. She's going to say, it's my family. And the reason for that, we don't realize this, but she sees the unity. Is a family per se a physical thing? No, it's a metaphysical thing. So it's natural for human beings to see the world around them in a metaphysical way and to be able to draw the conclusion that we are a unity. Now, to have a good idea of, to break it down, the law of unity is much more understandable if we talk about the law of sacrifice and the law of brotherhood. So we'll begin with the law of sacrifice. We've already gone like 2 pages into this. Okay, we've already gone 2 pages into the notes. Okay, so first of all, this idea of sacrifice is so misunderstood. Remember, we talk about, you know, false ideas so redirect our awareness, our attention, our consciousness. Religions look at sacrifice as what? As sacrifice the animal at the altar. They look at it as you know, during the Middle Ages, people would walk around from town to town beating themselves, self-flagellation as a sacrifice to God, so hopefully we'll get to heaven. Even today, in India, there are those who will sit in the same position with their hand held up in the air 24 hours a day for 10 years as a sacrifice to Shiva. is this going to earn their way into Brahma? It's a misunderstood idea of sacrifice. And of course, above and beyond all else is the idea that one man 2,000 years ago sacrificed himself on the cross so that everybody goes to heaven no matter what you do, as long as you believe certain things. This idea of sacrifice is misunderstood entirely, and it's because of false religious teachings. Now, if we took a look at the idea of sacrifice in the ancient teachings, think about it, Zoroastrianism, the Rig Veda, we're talking many, many, many times older than the other traditional religions. This idea of sacrifice, actually, in the Rig Veda, it is said that sacrifice is a thing. It's actually an aspect of Akasha, Akasha being the highest form of the astral. Sacrifice is an aspect of Akasha. It's part and parcel to the very creation of the universe. In Zoroastrianism, they talk about the ever-burning, omnipresent, yet invisible fire. And it's the fire of sacrifice. And he who sees it and understands it and participates in it builds a bridge with this fire from earth to the gods, and he can experience the dwelling of the gods while in this life if he climbs this bridge or crosses this bridge of sacrifice. So sacrifice to the ancients means something different than sacrifice to current day religion. If we look at sacrifice from an impersonal basis, and just consider this idea of cosmology, we talk about how the universe unfolds from within the unknowable absolute in seven ways, seven methods. These cosmic principles on a universal plane, on a universal basis, are all housed or encompassed or part and parcel to every human being. So every operation of principle that goes on in the creation of the universe goes on within the human being. We are told in the philosophy that Atman, universal Atman, by its own inherent power, sacrifices itself to Buddhi. And that universal Buddhi sacrifices itself on an individualized basis to universal mind or Mahat. And this comes down right to the what that means to us as human beings is on the level of wisdom, on the level of all knowledge, on the level of Buddhi, we participate in a common universal wisdom that is the accumulated wisdom of the ages of all human beings, and Buddhi is individualized in each human being. So man is one, yet men are many. And the fact is, we all know, it's one thing to say, well, we are all of the same essence, therefore we are all one. This is true. And we are all different. We are all sevenfold beings. And because we're sevenfold in all the different experiences, we are different. One is more of an intellectual basis, another is more emotional, and all the mixtures between the wisdom or vitality, et cetera, we could go on forever, makes up the differences. Similarly, but we have to be willing to, get past those differences and recognize the unity of law, the law of unity of all in all, similarly to a symphony where the deep pitch of the cello and the bass and the percussion participates in the symphony with what? The violin and the flute, with the shorter, higher pitch vibrations and the lower. And the harmony is created because they all sacrifice themselves to what? To the tempo of the maestro, a common tempo. They all sacrifice themselves to the key of the micro and to the notes necessary so that the symphony that we hear is one, but the instruments are many. And so in coming to learn about and understand the secret doctrine, we have to be willing to do whatever's necessary to prove that to ourselves. You know, nobody can sit here and make anybody believe any, because it takes work on an individual basis. And so we'll finish with just as a man is reborn into a life in order to work through and finish through effort to finish the causes set up in previous lives, and he does that whether or not he knows about the doctrine of reincarnation and karma. Similarly, a man is born at a certain time with certain cycles and certain conditions for him to work through and learn and grow, whether or not he is even aware of the law of cycles and the rise and fall of nations. So too, a man born into time and space benefits from the sacrifices of higher intelligences that have created a place and the circumstances for him to live and grow, whether or not he knows it, and his work and his effort results, and his sacrifice results in the creation of conditions for lower intelligences in which they will grow. Examples of that are Mother Nature. You know, we can talk about the cosmic, the Buddha, great mind, universal mind, but if we just look at Mother Nature, she sacrifices herself in billions of ways. She provides the substance for billions of form, so the matrix of every form is provided by Mother Nature, and the substance for every form is provided by Mother Nature for what? It's a sacrifice of her for benefit of the intelligence, the principle of intelligence, which flows through all forms, and the more experience that is gained by the intelligence in the form, so then the intelligence flows through to higher form and higher form and higher form. By the sacrifice of one principle in nature, so does another principle gain experience. That being said, we'll finish with the idea that we are all composite individuals. The sevenfold nature of man comes to us from cosmic principles, is worked on by the God within us, which by the time we have reached the state of perfected human being, we have taken those principles and we give them back to nature in the form of a perfected human being. So we sacrifice ourselves for great nature as well. So this will be followed up by the law of brotherhood.
Friends, one of the main objects of the work of the United Lodge of Theosophists in disseminating the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy is to teach that universal brotherhood based on the spiritual identity of all beings is a fact in nature. However, it is so pervasive a fact, seen to be governing in every department of nature, visible and invisible, it's more just to call brotherhood a universal law, the law of laws. In one of the devotional books that we study called The Voice of the Silence, we read that compassion is no attribute of a human being, nor a supreme being, for that matter. It is eternal, all-pervading harmony, the light of everlasting right and love radiating out of the darkness of absolute existence, which is no being, is a radiation from that one self of all. And that one self of all is also the self of what is called in that text Alaya, the universal soul, and all souls are rays of that one universal soul. Like the rays of the sun all have a common source. Now that may be the fact, but the more we become consciously one with that universal soul in our nature, the more we fill our being with the light of that divine radiance, the more we meld our awareness into that sense of eternal beingness, the more we become compassion absolute, not just compassion for this person or that person, but compassion like the light of the sun that shines on all equally, the good, the bad, the indifferent. The law of brotherhood and universal unity operates and manifests in nature as a tendency to restore harmony, joy, and righteousness wherever it is disturbed by discord, suffering, and harm. That's the way we see it operating in nature. Those who become more filled with that, with the awareness of that absolute compassion, that light, become conscious co-workers with that divine law in nature. And we see them throughout the world as being the peacemakers, the healers, the lovers of humanity, regardless of their race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. That is why it is said in our declaration that the Lodge considers as theosophists all those who are engaged in the true service of humanity, whether it is through loving devotion, healing, or peace. The universal brotherhood that is a fact in nature does not only rely on the spiritual identity of all beings in their essence with the one universal deific source of all life, consciousness, and being. All beings of whatever degree come from and share the same material essence. In fact, we could say that these two, we can call them, for the sake of discussion, universal spirit and universal substance, are the source of every world and being, every state and plane of consciousness, every force and creative power in nature. And so there is no point in space where there is not a reflection in some degree of this spirit and substance. Now we say that in the human being there is a pinnacle of development in the sense of all these different degrees are represented in the human being. Now, this is a very ancient conception. The old Hermetic saying was, as above, so below. And it summarizes in four simple words the tremendously complex and subtle affinities and correspondences that unite all the different departments of nature and all the manifested beings and all the kingdoms of nature in a universal web of life. It is like E equals MC squared, a universal formula, as above, so below, which is so simple in its expression, just like E equals MC squared, the interconnection, the brotherhood, the interdependence between energy and matter, spirit and substance. The ancient sages taught that man is a copy of the universe. The more sophisticated saying would be, man is a microcosm of the macrocosm. Every creative power that we see, every creative force that we can experience in nature is present potentially with the human being. If we see the awe-inspiring force of electricity and magnetism, of heat, of friction, of all those of motion, all those forces that we call the laws of nature that bring forth universes and solar systems and planets, all those are potential and can be awakened within the human being. As a matter of fact, we could not communicate or function on this plane at all unless we had in some degree those powers of creativity and force. So the human being in the invisible and visible departments of nature that we generally call body, soul, and spirit is connected with every visible and invisible department of nature. The body, soul, and spirit of nature. And the more we understand of those creative powers in us and their connection, the more we can bring forth and use in a conscious way the creative forces of the universe. So Theosophy teaches there is no miracle. The great testimony of the ages of human beings who seem godlike to us in their ability to love, to create, to understand, and to use the forces of nature at will, to defy, even as it seems, death, time, substance, matter. It was not miraculous. It was merely an operation of the law of brotherhood. And that is why the greatest of these taught ethics. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That is the golden rule, the universal law of brotherhood. So the ethical application of this law of brotherhood is altruism. Thought, words, deeds, based on a feeling of oneself in all beings and all beings in oneself. You might say a feeling of non-separateness, a feeling that is purposely nourished because we know in the world we live influenced by our senses and the ideas around us, it is very easy to adopt the feeling of separateness and to act in a selfish way, in disharmony with the law of brotherhood. But that very law, being a law of nature, will bring to us opportunities to reconsider and change our false ideas. A truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature, a clearer perception of divine wisdom, and a devotion and love to the welfare of all beings. These are not separate achievements. They are all one. They are all expression of the living power of theosophy. And that is the purpose of the United Lodge of Theosophists. Why are we here? Why do people sacrifice their time, their work, their money, their effort, year after year, to help themselves and to help those that are interested gain a better understanding? Because this living power of brotherhood is so this powerful, this living power of theosophy is so powerful that like a small candle in a dark room, it can give light and comfort to those who can't see their way in the darkness. So it only takes a few. But from the effort of those few, because of our interdependence, all are able to move forward and work in this world better than they were without that effort. So perhaps at this time you have some questions or comments on this universal law of unity in the two ways we can see it, the law of compassion and the law of brotherhood. Excuse me, the law of
sacrifice.
Yeah, law of sacrifice and the law of brotherhood.
Yes.
Reminds us of a saying. You did give us food and we did eat. Now we need to digest it. So the idea always comes up. To fill myself with light, maybe I need to go somewhere. Maybe I need to go meditate somewhere in the woods or isolate myself so that I can fill myself with light. And is that a theosophical way of looking at this? That we need to do something like that for ourselves to bring light to everyone else?
So to make the effort to fill ourselves with light, to set an example, to be brighter in service to others, it's not a matter of going somewhere to do it. It's a matter of going within. Now, the light's already there, but perhaps there's weeding that needs to be done to clear to clear the pastures. Perhaps there's some windows that need to be Windexed to let more light in. The light is present. But are the conditions within us such that it shines forth through us? That might be a consideration.
Well, let's apply that third fundamental of self-induced and self-devised effort, acknowledging that we are all in different stages of our understanding. And while it is not necessary to go searching around to this and that teacher, or this and that book, to gain that light, for most of us, at a particular point in evolution, we do have to search. And if that were not the case, we would not find ourselves in these rooms. And for many of us, although we may have had inklings and sparks here and there of that light, we really didn't understand it, but maybe it was enough to drive us to search, and maybe we searched in many different places, in many different books, and many different movements, until we came to a room or something like this, and the ideas we heard lit up the light that was already within us, and we could see this is true, not because of what they say, but because I recognize within myself through my own light of understanding that it's true. It's self-evident. I find myself to be in sympathy with these ideas.
In the green?
These are just incredible ideas, and we just kind of find that understand what is being said, but if we bring it down to a very practical level, how would we go about, in regards to the sacrifice, it's how do we learn to do that and universal brotherhood? I mean, we can say, yeah, we love everybody, but when somebody, we hear awful things in the news all the time, how can we love that person? So how do we do this on a practical level?
So how do we fulfill this sacrificial law on a practical level? Well, within the people, within our sphere, not to go to the TV yet, but within our sphere of people and family or work, without getting abstract and big and crazy, the very definite effort that we put in just to fulfill our duties, isn't that a sacrifice for others? And so if we want to do even more for them, then really are we really putting 100% into everything that we're doing? That could be a first step. If it wasn't our duty, restart that. Because it's our duty, we must, it's not just a personal thing. It's going to affect other people around us. And then not being one to watch TV too much for obvious reasons because of what's on it, but we think if something inflames us that we don't like, maybe the answer to that is to ask ourselves what is it within us that would bring judgment on that person. How fortunate we are to know that judgment is not the masters know that the last thing they need to do is judge us for our faults, right? Because that's just going to come back on them. So any kind of judgment that we may have, keep ourselves in check. What is it in me that's really firing up about that? Maybe that plays into it.
Yes?
My question about the law of sacrifice. There's a group of people in India called ascetics, where they believe the ultimate sacrifice is to renounce all the worldly pleasures and materialistic gains. And they live their entire life in an ascetic environment, renouncing all materialistic gains. The paradox here is that, nevertheless, their soul agreed to incarnate into the physical realm. So here they are in the physical, sacrificing it all back. It's a paradox that I can't quite put together. In other words, are they wasting their entire life? Or is this a wasted incarnation and they don't realize it, or what?
Fair question. So these ascetics that are going to these extremes, what are the wherefores for that? Well, first, let's just say, that's what brought Buddha upon the scene, to reform all that kind of stuff. And regardless of his efforts to reform it within Hinduism, the result was that there was a new religion, so to speak, started outside of Hinduism. And yet Buddha was followed up shortly thereafter by Shankaracharya, who made those reforms. Well, all right, so is it a wasted incarnation? There are some people who say, well, no effort is wasted. But if you're not mindful of what you're doing, we don't think that theosophy is very supportive, that you can waste a lot of time and a lot of effort if you're not assimilating lessons. What those guys are doing in a given lifetime, we can't speak to that, we don't understand it, but for sure, we're not encouraged to do it. It's not found in the philosophy, that's for sure. So it's probably a misinterpretation of something more sublime. That's all we can say.
Well, of course, it all depends on the motive.
Spiritual and development, that's it. They do it.
Well, it depends on the motive for spiritual development.
Ah, okay.
For my own salvation and reaching moksha, nirvana, depending on my tradition, or my spiritual development to gain as much knowledge as I can to sacrifice that final joy and liberation of moksha and nirvana so I can then share it with those that don't have as much as I. But at least to do everything I can to get that knowledge. And we know in order to do that, sacrifices have to be made, and sometimes certain things that were very useful to us at one point in our life have to be put aside so we can devote ourselves to those conditions that are going to be most conducive to gaining that knowledge. Now, the outside world may call that asceticism, but the teenager who doesn't go out drinking and partying every weekend so they can be swimming 6-7 days a week to prepare for the Olympics, are they ascetics? The parent who doesn't go out to the movies or bowling so that they can put that extra money into a fund to pay for their kids to go to college, are they ascetics? The law of sacrifice, the law of brotherhood, requires a certain amount of isolation or giving up of certain things. But the mere act of giving up things physically, if it's not accompanied by an inner renunciation, is hypocritical. So to sit in a monastery or to sit in a forest and constantly dwell on these things and say prayers to get rid of these things constantly, but believing that you're better off for being separate from the world, that's kind of hypocritical. Perhaps the best way for you to learn how to control those things is to be in the field of action and renounce the results of interest in your activities. That's what Krishna taught. Krishna was the spiritual warrior, the spiritual warrior soul in incarnation, performing one's duty, as you're pointing it out.
Yes.
We came to listen the declaration made in impression.
Speak up, please.
The declaration made an impression. However, a statement such as "I never was not, nor shall I ever cease to be," caused a great deal of confusion. Then we heard about hope and responsibility and the simplicity of these laws, the declaration and so forth. What does it mean? And how can we use that term, even though we do not grasp it immediately? "I never was not, nor shall I ever cease to be."
I, as that spiritual entity, the spiritual essence in me that is one with the Absolute, shall never cease to be. However, our awareness of that can cease and begin. Certainly, when we pass through the waking state into the dream state, and we go into that deep sleep state, at least for us, as we are, for that time, we are not self-consciously aware of ourselves as individual beings. It's sort of a deep sleep. And then we come into this active waking state, and that continuity of I continues. The philosophy would teach, though, even though our self-conscious awareness on this plane may cease, the reality of ourselves as spiritual beings does not cease. We continue to actively perceive and work on inner planes of existence. So it is our fundamental unity, our spiritual identity, the basis of brotherhood and sacrifice. That spiritual identity is what never ceases to be.
We already, the question is, how do we do this practically? We already know how. Any loved one who needs our help, we are ready to sacrifice whatever we need to help them, because we regard them as one we know and love. So compassion comes in there. If we can do it with that one, what we need to do is expand the idea that that one is the same as I, is the same as thee, and anyone else we see walking down the street. So an expansion of that idea and a conscious doing at the time will help us. So the ascetic may be sitting and in contemplation, sending out wonderful, healing, loving thoughts to all the earth. That will help us. And that is a sacrifice that one has made, giving up the terrestrial life, as it were, in order to practice this however long they decide to. So, in a sense, we already are aware of what we need to do. We need to expand that and be compassionate consciously when we're doing it, either of those examples.
Thank you. And well, to that we would add, you know, asceticism, when we talk about that, we're talking about asceticism per se. The false interpretation of what sacrifice is, destroying your ability to create, believing that it's going to save you. That we're talking about the false ideas associated with sacrifice, and they're out there.
Well, along with that expansion, what is it that prevents, or what is it that nourishes the expansion of the ideas we hold? What we're really saying is we need to expand our ideas. And the fundamental idea that we need to expand is our idea of self. That's why the truer realization of the self goes hand in hand with a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. If your concept of self is only your own human frame in this life, then you'll forget about the rest of your family. If it begins to expand out and say, that is my brother, that is my sister, that is my mother, and I can say whatever I want to them, but you better not. I'm allowed to, you know, do this, that, because they are become part of yourself. You feel you're not just blood relatives, but you feel that identity. And perhaps it expands out to the nation, and you're a soldier, and you feel yourself you feel the nation within yourself and yourself within the nation, and you're willing to give up the greatest, you're ready and willing to give up the greatest sacrifice we think a human being can do, that is to give up their life if necessary to protect the government and the people that live under that government. That is another expansion. But how about those who then identify with all people? With all human beings, with all beings in all the different departments of nature. They feel that all in themselves and themselves in all beings. Their idea of brotherhood, their idea of self is much greater than where we might be at this time.
So we've been using the term sacrifice a lot, and it's a, you know, sacrifice brings along the, you know, image of like sacrificing your life or something. But I guess my question is, like, when you talk about sacrifice more on a day-to-day basis, and we've been talking about a lot of kind of, I guess, sacrificing your, almost like a sense of self, like a selfishness or egocentric, is that kind of more a way to think about sacrifice on a more, like a day-to-day? And then it makes me think about, like, there's a term where I think there's kind of concept where in order to, like, build yourself or better yourself to, like, for the betterment of helping others and improving your own life, you have to kind of break down yourself and then build yourself back up. So is that sacrifice similar to that, where you're not really, like, destroying or obliterating the self, but more like sacrificing your current state or whole and then building it back up and reincorporating and brings it back to, I think when you're talking about the ascetics, where it's you have to incorporate the material or your own interests within the field and not like it should, you know, eschew them completely. So.
Well, so to answer the last second part of that of the two part question or contribution or whatever it was.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
You know, a young adult joins the military. There's a challenge. There's a boot camp. The first thing that happens is the drill sergeant breaks them down and changes ideas about themselves of what they are and who they are. And then at a certain point, and it's a cycle, there is a science to it. And then at a certain point, starts building them back up again. And the result is that the young adult recognizes that he can do or she can do more than they ever had thought possible. But what they thought about themselves first had to be dismissed. Similarly, a student who comes to theosophy from an orthodox religion, from a traditional, you know, received traditional training, to fully apprehend or comprehend or understand or come in sympathy with this system of thought that we call universal theosophy, he's got to break down certain aspects, certain ideas. He's got to dismiss certain ideas that perhaps for generations in his family have been thought to be true. So in certain ways, you know, it's easier for someone, some people say this, it's easier for someone who has had no religious training whatsoever to walk into a lodge and adapt and learn, you know, but there's two sides of that. You know, someone who has had religious training has often a certain level of reverence. When they see how important something is, there's something special in their heart and recognize it. And there are people who are raised without religion who it just doesn't click. You know, the whole idea of reverence for high ideas is candy, you know? Hmm. So yes, there's a breaking down and a building up, and with respect to the first part of the question about, you know, the sacrifice and the adjustment that maybe we have to make in terms of the ego, keeping our ego in check, you know, there's the statement in the philosophy where that power which the true disciple shall covet is the power which will make him appear as nothing in the eyes of men. And keeping the ego in check might be consistent with that. So if one tests it out, maybe it's helpful to remember that. Just break down the word sacrifice, sacred, and FIC, the Latin root for faith. So have faith in the sacredness of the idea and test it for yourself.
We would add to that that before it was mentioned that sacrifice in its impersonal expression of law is the necessity for the cooperation or participation of all separate elements in one whole. So each gives of itself a portion of itself for the sustaining of the whole. So we might say when a human being sacrifices, they make all their individual or personal actions sacred. The making our acts sacred to the whole is an act of sacrifice. So in that case, riding to work, cleaning up the house, preparing dinner, the most everyday activities we can think of with the right thought and feelings, are sacrifices are made sacred to the benefit of all. So we can keep that idea in mind. It was spoke about previous generations of students here at this lodge, and one of those students who would very frequently work from the platform used to say, sacrifice is giving up the dearer for the better. In every choice we make, there is something that's more dear to us and something we recognize that it's better for us to be doing. And the ever-present willingness to give up that which we cherish, if at the same time we can accomplish something better, is a very simple and practical way in which we can practice brotherhood and sacrifice.
Yes, in the blue.
The ability to identify with the rest of humanity, the brotherhood component of that, implies the ability to identify with the guy who blew up a bus full of innocent people, let's say. And in my mind, I'm trying to reconcile how to do that. So do I simply view the fact that the soul behind this man's actions is weeping at the vehicle's behavior? And do I simply disengage the vehicle from the soul, understanding that there is a soul behind this vehicle, but it wasn't the soul carrying out the actions, it was simply a broken down vehicle?
Well,
so is that the correct way of viewing this?
Yes, but we just wanted to expand on it philosophically. So the basis of universal brotherhood is recognizing the spiritual identity of all beings, or the spiritual identity of all souls, if you will. It's not based on whether or not that person's acting the way we'd like them to act or not, whether we agree with the way they are acting, whether we agree with what they're saying or doing or not. It's based on the fact that there is a soul in evolution. We are souls in evolution, obviously at different degrees of development, but as souls, as thinkers, we all share that same potential power to choose, and in essence, we all participate to greater or lesser degree in that one light of spirit. And from that basis of unity, we can then look perhaps with pity, understanding, compassion at that being, not at the act, but at that being. And we try to act as efficiently, as appropriately with dealing with the circumstance. But we bring to that situation the understanding that we are all one in essence. So at this point, we have time for another question. There was a hand. You had your hand up. Yes.
Earlier, when you were speaking of sacrifice and things that you inherited from your society, from your family, it echoed the Gita, that's the whole story of the Gita, these ideas and these traditions and customs that we're born into. We have to examine them, get rid of some of them, build some of them up in order to be better than we were when we first met them. That was.
And sometimes when we do that, we find ourselves surprised that we may get struggles from those old teachers and friends that talk to us, but we also might see that our very actions serve as an example and plant some seeds in some of those individuals. So sometimes we help others to the extent that they are open and ready to be helped in that way.
Yes.
When we found out the simplicity of these teachings, look within, not without. There's a unity one may discover within himself, which when we look around, we see only differences.
Look within and look without. Look above and look below. How can you see the unity of life if you are not looking in all directions? But remember, while you're looking around and above and below, that the reality, the enduring aspects of life are within and above. The changing, fleeting aspects of life, which are just as important, is what's around. So where are you going to ground yourself? Where are you going to place your faith in? Where are you going to act from? That which is like shifting sand, or that which is firm? And that's our challenge. So we're going to continue next week with this idea of the synthesis of science and religion, law and ethics, to see that they're not separate, but all one, and take a look at the law of justice and mercy. Our meeting's adjourned.
Sometimes the simplest ideas are the most electrifying.